Hey, before we jump into this week's episode, it's important for you to know that we have launched the registration for the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit, where we were going to have 25 plus presenters, speakers, authors, college professors, individuals with rich experience in the world of teaching, presenting to us on how we can enhance the teaching ability in our wards and stakes across the world. So go to leadinglds.org. There'll be an obvious place there to grab your free ticket to this virtual summit. It's like an online conference that starts March 15th, but you got to register in order to attend for free. So go to leadinglds.org. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. As a Utah boy, I have always loved the Utah Jazz. I mean, John Stockton is by far the best player to ever play in the history of the NBA. I don't care what anybody else says, he's the man. I love the Utah Jazz, specifically John Stockton. Now, you can imagine my delight with this past history of fandom that I have when I got the opportunity to interview Gail Miller, who is the chairwoman of Larry H. Miller Group of Companies and also one of the owners of the Utah Jazz. She's recently written a book called Courage to Be You, Inspiring Lessons from an Unexpected Journey, which is published by Desert Book, and you probably have seen it already in many of the bookshelves at Desert Book or online. It is available. Now, whether it was her intent or not, this book is a leadership book. It is fantastic. It's biographical, obviously, talks about her story and her upbringing. But throughout the book are specific leadership principles that she places in there and lives by and leads by that are truly inspiring. And one of those experiences she had in her life was being a Relief Society president. So in this interview, we talk about her time as a Relief Society president and the various principles she applied there. They're quite inspiring. And of course, we also talk about leading one of the largest organizations in Utah. This is truly an inspiring interview. And as you can see, this is a bonus episode coming out outside of our typical Sunday release because her book recently came out. And I want to give a shout out to Desert Book and to Gail Miller, all the hard work they've done to write this fantastic work, and they are trying to promote it. So by listening to this, you need to know, you need to go to online, to desertbook.com, to Amazon, wherever you buy books, and purchase this book by Gail Miller. Again, it's called Courage to Be You, Inspiring Lessons from an Unexpected Journey. So here is my interview with Gail Miller, chairwoman of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. Gail Miller, welcome to the Leading LDS podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, and in a beautiful office in Sandy, Utah, and they overlook the movie theaters.
On the other side,
I guess they're not out this window. But right. Now, obviously, we have an international audience. I think of people, the majority of them are from Utah and obviously know your name well and have created memories with your family through Utah Jazz basketball, through movies, through all sorts of things. But for maybe somebody international who isn't familiar with your name, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, I am the owner and chair of the board of directors of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies, which includes 80 different companies, primarily automotive. We started in the car business with one dealership. We now have 65. And so we've grown there over the last, well, since 1979. It's grown tremendously. We've added the Utah Jazz. We've added the Bees baseball team. We had a racetrack in Tooele that we could not make profitable, so we sold that. We have about 200 screens of movie theaters in Utah, up and down the Wasatch Front, many auto-related businesses, subprime business. So a lot of things that complement what our main businesses do.
Absolutely. And I'm sure, did some people think you just own the Jazz and that's it?
That's the big name.
Right? That's for sure. Now, and you recently released a book called Courage to Be You, Inspiring Lessons from an Unexpected Journey, released through Desert Book, and I had the opportunity to review this. And when I first picked it up, I thought, oh, this will be interesting because I read the biography about your husband, your late husband, Larry, called Driven, and loved that. And it was interesting to hear his story. And I thought, oh, great, this is Gail's side of that story. But really, it was something different, right?
Well, it's kind of Gail's side, but it's my life as I lived it in a parallel realm to Larry. I was raising the children. I was doing all of the other half of our life. while he was building the business.
Yeah. And so what was the impetus for writing this book? Is this something you always wanted to do, or was it outside encouragement?
Well, if you read the book, you'll see that I spend a lot of time in therapy, yeah. which is probably shocking to some people because you don't talk about that. That's right. Kind of a taboo subject, but I needed it. I had children who needed it, and I spent a lot of time. And when I was through, or after Larry died, the therapist said to me, "Why don't we write a book? You've had a lot of experiences that other women can benefit from in your journey." So I tried it, but it just didn't work for me. I wasn't ready because I couldn't see any benefit in talking about the things I'd been through. And several years later, after my son Brian had written another book about Larry called Behind the Drive, he said, "Mom, let me help you write your book." So he encouraged me, and I committed to weekly interviews. We gathered a lot of information, and then they thought, well, there's too much good stuff here. We need to talk to Deseret Book and see if they'd be interested in publishing your story. And surprisingly, they were, and they hooked me up with Jason Wright. Jason interviewed me. We came up with the manuscript, and that's where we are today.
That's great. That's great. And for, on a personal note, I got the book, and I started preparing for this interview and reading it, and I was about halfway through the first introduction, and my wife came into the room and said, "What are you reading?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm reading Gail Miller's book." And I stopped and said, "You know what? I should read this out loud." So my wife and I had a beautiful experience. I read out loud every word. And we stopped at several occasions and talked about things. You know, you talk about money, about raising families, about work-life balance. And it was such a beneficial experience as a couple to read it.
Thank you. I'm very flattered.
So if there's one, if you wrote it for just one couple, you've accomplished it. This is good. So, and I appreciated so much just the tone of the book of being real. You know, there's one quote you said that my spiritual routines don't necessarily look like something you'd see in the Ensign or a video on the church website. And there's, I think so many people feel that way, right? And I'm sure people can look at you and think, "Oh, she's got life figured out."
I'm afraid that's what happens more often than not. And it's really not true. We all go through these challenging periods in our life, and we all have to find our way and what works for us. And for me, even growing up, we did not have family home evening or family prayer on a regular basis. We did have a very founding gospel-centered upbringing and knew that that was, you know, where we came from, who we were, what we were here for, and where we were going. So I had a lot of Bible stories. That was my foundation. And then even as a married couple, we did not, with Larry, we did not establish a good routine until much later in our marriage, where we finally determined that this really was an important thing for raising children. And then we started trying to do the things that normal people do, but our routines were just not there.
Yeah. And it wasn't necessarily about creating the ideal routine, but having a routine that you could say, well, that's good enough and it's working.
Right. Something that worked for us. Yeah. And I'm sorry to say it. The children learned the gospel, but we didn't have regular family home evenings.
Yeah.
And part of that was because when Larry was available, he couldn't understand that you only needed to spend 5 or 10 minutes on a lesson. It was the whole evening. And that was hard for our kids.
Yeah. And I appreciated your candidness about your marriage. That sometimes, you know, it wasn't the perfect marriage all the time. And I think there's one moment you said, we both thought about divorce at one time, but luckily it wasn't at the same time, right?
Right. That's very true. And I would bet most couples go through that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate how relatable it was. And so I thought that was well written. In the book, you talk about a time you were called as a Relief Society president. About what stage in your marriage were you at when that call came?
That was late in our marriage. I'm trying to think how old I was. I probably late 50s, maybe early 60s. And the bishop came and asked me to be the Relief Society president. And I was at a point in my life where I could see some free time, some space where I could do some of the things I wanted to do that I'd been putting off for a long time. And when he asked me, I said, "Are you sure?" I am just wanting to spend my time doing this and this and this. And he said, "I can promise you that if you will take this calling, you will have the time you need to do the things that are important." And that actually really happened, because it made me think about what was important. Mm-hmm. And then it made me understand that I didn't need a whole day to do something important. I could take a few minutes here and a few minutes there, still get the things accomplished that I wanted to focus on and be of service.
Yeah.
And it was a great time. It was probably the best calling I ever had.
Hmm. So it sounds like a lot of the times in life when we want to move on to a next project, we feel like the whole week has to open up, or the whole, each day I have to have some hours spent towards that.
But yeah, and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. So what was it about that calling that you really reflect back on that made it one of your favorites?
Well, the ward we lived in was just a really great ward. We had a lot of elderly people in it. Hmm. My experiences in life had prepared me for the things that I would face as a Relief Society president. I had had kids that had had trouble. I had had an aging mother who I had been a caretaker for. I had had difficulty in marriage. I mean, just all the things that I had experienced that gave me a foundation to be able to help in the areas that were needed in our ward.
Hmm. And I love some of these stories where, you know, as far as the elderly woman suffering from dementia and the scrapbooking the life of a child, I mean, they really touched my heart. And that's what the calling's all about, right? It's not about organizing the visiting teaching. Was that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. And we, as a presidency, were able to create a lot of beneficial experiences for the whole ward. Hmm. I didn't just focus on the women. We did things like create a Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which is a program where you have maybe five or six couples come to your home, and each one brings a different part of the meal, and you prepare the main course, and you don't let everybody know who's coming, so that when they get there, it's a surprise.
Oh, interesting.
And you get to interact with people that you might not otherwise. Huh. So that was fun. We had a scripture reading class that the women loved. We did many things. I had a movie day for the elderly women who couldn't get out to a movie theater. I had one in my home. So once a month, we'd show a movie, invite the older ladies over and have lunch. And they loved the social activity. So,
yeah. And was it intentional? I mean, did you step back and think, we're not going to just create experiences for the women? Because I think a lot of Relief Society presidents can get caught up with the quarterly activities and, you know, on to the next one. Was that intentional thought of, we're going to have an imprint on the ward?
Yes, it was, because families are very important, and you have to have both parents involved. Now, women are the nurturer, but a man has to come along and be a part of it to make it complete.
Yeah, I love that. And I chuckled at the references to your husband now, who was in that ward, right? And his house caught on fire twice.
Right.
Is that right? And so you had to step in and help as a Relief Society president and contribute to that.
Well, it wasn't just that his house caught on fire twice. His wife was homebound. Well, she had MS.
Oh my goodness.
And diabetes. So I had an opportunity to know her and serve her and love the children. And that made it easy when it came time to start dating, because we knew each other's spouses.
And yeah.
It was very comfortable.
I bet that's a blessing in your marriage that you knew each other before, right?
And can relate to what kind of people we are.
Yeah. You also, as far as reaching out to inactive members, you tell of the story of early in your marriage when you and Larry, you know, first newlyweds, and, you know, going to church wasn't a priority. And so you were sort of the inactive member on the rolls, right?
We were. In fact, we lived in an area in Sugar House, which is the southeast quadrant of Salt Lake. And Larry played softball. And there was a team in that ward that wanted him to play on their team. And the only way he could qualify is to go to church once a month.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So that got him there.
So we did go to church, but we didn't get involved in the ward. And that experience in the book about the home teacher coming to our home on a Sunday morning was, it's not something I'm proud of, but it was where I was at the time. I didn't want that involvement. I didn't want to be pursued.
Yeah. And there's somebody I'm assigned a home teacher right now that is a similar situation. Me and my companion went over there. I'm assigned with a teacher. We knock on the door and introduce ourselves and said, would it be okay if we came and visit? And she said, no, not really. I'm like, okay, well, can we at least stop by and just say hi? Yeah, you can. Okay, we'll start there, you know. So how did that experience of inactivity influence your time as Relief Society president? Is that something you referenced?
They were a long time apart. Hmm. That was early in our marriage where I was rude to the home teacher.
So you've come a long way.
I've come a long way. And being a Relief Society president was kind of the end of my period of my life, you know.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot in between.
Yeah. And I love this, the sweet interaction. You mentioned Bishop Lowell Matson. Is that correct? And his response to Larry and his encouragement to Larry. It sounds like he was encouraging, but not overbearing.
He was what we call taking the assumptive clothes.
Nice.
Because he knew Larry's character and he knew what a benefit he could be to that ward. And this was early in our marriage when we lived in Colorado. But his ulterior motive was he had children that he wanted Larry to be able to influence. Hmm. And so he was very gentle, but firm in his ability to get Larry to come back and be involved first, just as a coach, a volleyball coach.
Yeah.
And then as the assistant teacher's quorum advisor, and then the teacher's quorum advisor, and then he finally got him to do home teaching, and elder's quorum came along and got him to come to priesthood. And so little by little by little,
yeah,
they helped to activate him.
And so was it, did the bishop tell Larry up front, like, hey, I really want you to have an influence on these young men? I mean, you're good at that. Was that sort of the sell?
Yeah, it really was. Actually, the sell was, you need this, we need this, tell me how we can come together. And they actually negotiated like a job to give. Larry said, I play softball. And the bishop said, well, how often do you play softball on Sunday? And he told him, he says, so that leaves this many open. Bishop said, okay, I'll take them.
Yeah. Nice. So was it early on in that relationship between Larry and that bishop, was it, how did that bishop start to nurture that relationship so that he could have those conversations, that Larry would actually show up at his office? Was it with the softball?
Well, that bishop was, Larry was handed off to that bishop.
Okay, gotcha.
There was the bishop before him was named David Brown, and he's the one that really made inroads to begin with and softened Larry a little bit. And then he was called to be stake president, and that took him out of the ward. And so he made sure that the next bishop knew what he'd been doing and followed up with Larry.
Nice. And so how many years would you say from the time you were married to the time you felt very much that you were weekly attending committed members? What type of time span?
Well, it was different for me and different for Larry. When we moved to Colorado, we were not active at all. And that was 5 years after we got married. Now, early in Larry's life, as a teenager, his parents actually left the church, and they encouraged him to leave the church, too.
Oh, wow.
But he had a lot of friends in his neighborhood that rallied around him and kept him active. And so as we were dating, I was working on Sunday. He was playing softball. We just kind of drifted away. We didn't lose our testimony. Yeah. We just drifted out of that routine. And when we moved to Colorado, my oldest child was 5. And one day he said to me, Mommy, where does God live? And I thought, oh my goodness, I know where he is. I'm just assuming they know all that I know. And they weren't getting it. So that was the first year we lived in Colorado. And I found the ward, got the kids into primary and started going. But it took Larry a lot longer. I'd say maybe 3 or 4 more years before he began to be active. By the time we came back to Utah 8.5 years later, we were both totally active. So the people in Colorado were very diligent and very kind, very gentle, very persuasive. And then the following year, we came back to Utah in 1979. In 1980, we went to the temple to be sealed. So that's the kind of work they did for us over there.
Wow. Interesting. You talk a lot about this maybe sounds wrong, but you talk about death in the book. You experienced death as a child, losing a baby sister,
right? Uh-huh.
And then obviously with the passing of your husband, and then even tragic death of a child. Right. And you talk about this this dynamic of saying the right thing. And I think a lot of bishops, a lot of Relief Society presidents show up at a home after the loss of a loved one. They want to give comfort. What advice would you give to them if they're sitting in front of somebody who's just lost somebody? What can they really do for them?
Well, I think the best thing they can do is say, tell me about what you're feeling. Tell me about your husband or whoever the loved one is. Tell me what memories you have. Let them talk about it and be comforted by their own experiences. Because you don't really know what they're going through. You don't know what they've been through in most cases. But to let them recount to you kind of, it heals the heart, because then they can dwell on good memories, fond things that they've got in their mind. And they don't want to hear what you're talking, how it affects you. Yeah. They want you to know how it affects them.
Because I think it's easy to just default to like, oh, I remember when I lost my mom, or, you know, this is my experience, but to just sit back and listen and right. their experience and memories of that loved one.
Wow. It's much nicer for them.
Yeah, that's great advice. You know, one topic me and my wife talked at length about in the book, as Larry was having more and more success, you know, become more of a prominent figure in the community of Utah and business circles, you sort of woke up one day and found yourself that you weren't so much Gail Miller as you were Larry Miller's wife. And I think, you know, there's a lot of spouses of leaders that listen to this, both, you know, husbands of Relief Society presidents or wives of bishops. And my wife shared her experience when I was bishop that, yeah, you sort of, the attention towards turns towards the spouse, the leader, you know, right. because he's the leader of the ward, he's the bishop. And
it's the adored one.
The adored one, right? And so the wife is just sort of in the background. And what advice could you give to a bishop's wife, for example, that feels more like the bishop's wife rather than sister, whomever?
Well, I've never been the bishop's wife, so.
Well, yeah.
But for me, what I had to realize was that my growth and my development did not depend on someone else. Mm. It depended on what I did for me. And I had to take the initiative to develop my sense of well-being, my sense of purpose, my sense of what is it that I want to be doing, supporting, helping, showing, learning. When I had that experience with Larry, it wasn't so much that I felt worthless. It was that I was stymied. I was kind of stopped in my progress because I didn't have the experiences he was having out in the public where he was doing something new and exciting every day, meeting new people, learning new things. And I was at home with the kids, but it didn't mean I didn't have any opportunity to learn. I just had to make my own. I couldn't rely on what he was doing.
Yeah.
I had to stay up with the level of learning that he was having so that I felt compatible. Mm. So I began paying attention to what was going on in the world. I began to interact with people on a more friendly level so I would have associations that I could rely on. I looked to friends in the ward that I had things in common with. When I explained to Larry that I was feeling inadequate, he said, well, why don't you take a painting class? And he bought me a set of paints. And I
did that help? That. Or?
I did try that, but I'm not the artist I wish I was. But anything that you do that increases your ability to grow helps in that area.
And this is maybe more of a question for the wife of an entrepreneur, but was there a point where that you went to Larry and said, listen, you own 3 dealerships now. We have more money than we thought we'd ever need. Just stop. Like, let's just chill out here. Focus on the family. What was that dynamic
like? Absolutely. I did say that quite often. Every time he'd buy a new dealership, I'd say, why do you want another one? And I was thinking selfishly in that if you didn't have so much to do, you could be more involved in the family.
Yeah.
But his answer was quite surprising to me. He said, I do it because I can create good jobs for a lot of people so that they can have good lives. Mm. And if only one of the couple works, the other one can stay home with the children, and that's a benefit. Well, right then I knew we are absolutely right. And the only thing is, we should have been able to find a better balance.
Sure. In hindsight, there's probably a better balance, right? But I loved like the story of, I think it was a Monday night for family evening. You just went to his office and went to a nearby restaurant and you just said, good enough. We're having dinner together as a family. We're talking. It's not a perfect family home evening, right? But
we
good
did
enough.
That fairly often just because that's the only way we could spend time together.
Yeah.
Or we would go have I did that for a family portrait. Took his clothes up to him because he didn't wear a suit, but took up what he wanted, what he was going to wear, took the kids. We all went and had our portrait taken and took him back to work and we went home. Whatever worked, you know?
And so, I mean, you sort of just stepped up to that role of saying, you know, if, you know, Larry's doing some good in the world in general and the community, and I'm going to bring some balance to this and we're going to make it work. It's not going to be perfect. Right?
Yeah. Wow. And that kind of goes into the chapter that talks about patience and patiently waiting. Yeah. There's a difference between waiting and being patient. You can be patient and still be active. And that's what I was doing. I'm patient with what he's doing, but I'm not going to wait around and sacrifice what I want. So
it's
kind of an interesting balance.
Yeah, for sure. And with that topic of patience, just, you know, that I think that's a good message for anybody in general, but also sisters that are striving in a religion that sometimes seems overwhelming and demanding. And I remember as a bishop, just not sure what to do, you know, with sisters in the society that just appeared to, they just sort of are always down on themselves. You know, I try to encourage them, but at the end of the day, I couldn't relate as well. Any advice to a Relief Society president or bishop to really encourage women in the ward?
Well, I think recognizing their individual talents or their individual needs is really important. I remember one lady when I was Relief Society president who never got her visiting teaching done. And when I called her in for the review, which we did twice a year, I think, about what was going on and why she couldn't do that, she said, "My kids just take too much of my time." Hmm. So my solution was, look, you don't need to be a visiting teacher right now. You have your plate full. Focus on what's important to you. And when you have time, let's get you back in the routine. Mm. She was so grateful for that because it took the guilt away.
Yeah.
It let her focus on what she really wanted to focus on. And I think sometimes we expect too much from our women. Mm. They think they have to be perfect. They think they have to be the perfect homemaker, the perfect mother, the perfect churchgoer, and we don't.
Yeah.
We have to be the perfect daughter of God.
Yeah.
And not more than what we can do.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And what a, you know, I think as leaders sometimes we don't realize we have that power to just say, you know what, why don't you take a break for a couple months or a year or whatever, and we can revisit this later. That's great. Now, as obviously the chairwoman of Larry H. Miller Group of Companies, you've got a few things to do day to day, decisions to make. I mean, you're a leader in this company. And I love the chapter about, or the discussion you talked about making decisions. You say, you know, we don't stay on our knees all day patiently waiting. After the praying, we wait patiently on our feet, in motion and always seeking to do good. I pray daily to know how to better lead the company that bears my last name. But then, after a period of pondering, I have to get up, stretch myself, and make decisions. And I love that because I think so many leaders, especially, you know, newly called leaders that maybe don't have a secular leadership experience, they're petrified by these decisions, by this burden that's on them. But sometimes you just have to make decisions.
Sometimes you do. And really, you have to realize which decisions are yours to make. Mm. And then make the right decision, or what you think is the right decision. But you can also delegate for other decisions. There are people all around you that are doing their job and they're doing it well. Let them do. And just make sure you're overseeing so that things don't slip through the cracks and get lost. But I have a coach who tells me, the person with the power to make the decision makes the decision. Hmm. Now, that's not always me. It's the president of the sports and entertainment, or it's the lead manager of the automotive department. I don't have to make those decisions because I've entrusted the power to do that to very capable people. And then I have to rely on their good judgment.
Yeah. And do you find yourself wanting to sometimes, you know, put your finger in their organization or jump in and make a better decision? Or how do you avoid that micromanagement dynamic?
I really try not to do that at all. It doesn't mean I'm not interested. I am interested in everything that goes on here, and I want to know everything that goes on, but I don't want to overstep my bounds when I've given them responsibility to do something. So it's a fine balance. And with being the owner, I naturally want to make sure everything is done well, but that's where having good people comes in. If you pick the best and you train them and you allow them to do their job, you really don't have to worry a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, and as we wrap up here, you know, you talked a lot about stewardship near the end of the book, and it makes me, you know, what I appreciate about you and Larry so much is that, you know, as I read Larry's book, that obviously he was very driven, hence the title of the book, but it didn't seem to me that he woke up one day as a teenager and thought, I'm going to own a bunch of car dealerships and a basketball team, and I'm going to be one of the wealthiest persons in Utah, and that's my goal, right? But he just kept realizing the opportunity in front of him. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. When we bought that first dealership, that was a means to support our family. And we thought, okay, this will be great. This is what we'll be doing the rest of our life. And as opportunities came along to expand our business, we were in a situation to do it, and it turned out well, but we didn't ever set out to create an empire.
Yeah.
And along the way, as we did things and we developed the business, we realized there's more to life than amassing a fortune. It's what you do with that fortune that's important.
Yeah.
And we fortunately had the same outlook about money. We didn't covet having it and hoarding it. We wanted to do good things with it. Yeah. And so as we've been able to, then we've stepped into that arena and tried to do a lot of good things with our wealth that benefit lots of people, not just us.
Yeah. And that stewardship and that influence has even expanded to helping the poor and the needy, the homeless that you're involved in. What advice would, obviously the bishops are tasked with the duty of seeking out the poor and the needy. And obviously we have an incredible welfare program and things like that. But how, and a lot of times as a bishop, it felt very reactive. They came to me for the check, right? Or the help. But what advice would you give to bishops or others in the church that could be more proactive in helping those poor and the needy, especially the homeless?
That's a very interesting question. And it's different for all areas. I know in the ward that I live in, which is a downtown ward, we have homeless people that come to our sacrament meeting and our relief society. And I noticed Sunday that there's one lady who's been there from the very beginning, and she was there before we lived in the ward. The first Sunday I saw her, she was sitting out in the foyer, and I went in and sat down in sacrament meeting. And then I thought, I'm going to go back out and ask her if she wants to sit by me. Hmm. Well, she didn't, but she said, no, I don't come in because I can't see very well. But I noticed this last Sunday that the Relief Society had given her a job.
Oh, that's great.
Handling the microphones, because we have a big ward and a lot of older people, and it's hard to hear when people talk. To me, that's real progress.
Yeah.
That's showing that there's value there and that she is worth giving attention to, and that helps her. Now, I don't know what will happen, but
yeah,
I think with most homeless, they want to work. They want to have an opportunity to be like everyone else. They don't want to be homeless. The ones you see on the street that are begging and sleeping on the street, they may not want help, and they cause the whole homeless issue to have a bad name. Mm. But the majority of those who have to stay in shelters and are looking for a job and trying to find a home, they're the ones that we need to help get where they want to go. Help the ones we can, get services for those we can't help so that they can get healthy enough to want to get out of homelessness. And it takes a village. We can't do it alone. We can, an individual can give money to a homeless shelter. They can take socks or underwear or coats or whatever, blankets, those things help. But I would just advise anyone who wants to help to look for ways to do it. That's an incredible group of people that help the homeless.
Yeah, great advice. Love that. I do have one final question for you, but any encouragement? I mean, people can pick up the book at Deseret Book. Anything else people should know to get their hands on the book and read the great words you've written?
Well, it'll be released. It's actually in bookstores now.
Okay.
But the official published date is March 5th.
Okay.
I noticed yesterday it is on Amazon. So it's going forward. I hope it's received well. And
nice. So if you know where to buy a book, you can probably find it.
Right.
Nice. Well, one last question. You know, as you've had opportunity to lead in many ways in life, in the community and in your church ward, how has your experience as a leader made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think the service aspect of our church is so aligned with what Christ did, that when you serve, you cannot help but become more like him, because you see the world through different eyes. I know as a daughter, I admired my mother, I revered her, I honored her, but it wasn't until I served her that I really learned to love her.
Mm.
And that's because I saw her in a different way. I saw her as someone who had given her whole life to serving other people and now had to step down from that responsibility and be served. And that's not easy. That's one part about our church that's really hard, is to be the one who's being served. Mm. But to become like Christ, we have to do both. We have to serve and we have to be served.
That concludes my interview with Gail Miller. Man, I'm so grateful for these opportunities. Sometimes I just have to pinch myself because I get such an opportunity to interview some incredible people, and I hope you benefit from it as well. I had such an incredible time, and Gail was so down to earth, so nice and willing to chat with me, and she didn't seem rushed at all, and so kind. And so definitely go out and check out this book, read it, share it, give it as a gift. You know, I was thinking as I was reading it with my wife that this would make a fantastic gift for a young woman to read, or even a recently returned sister missionary. Now, obviously, anybody, boy or girl, would benefit from this, but we definitely need to highlight more examples of women in leadership like Gail. And so what a fantastic, inspiring gift it would be for somebody who's just jumping into life, right? And growing up and experiencing the world. They will be inspired by Gail's words. And don't forget to go to leadinglds.org and also sign up for your free admission to the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit, where we tackle all things teaching within the LDS context. It's going to be fantastic. It starts March 15th, but you got to go get a free ticket to participate. Go to leadinglds.org and sign up. Until next time, be a leader, not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.